First, biologists are using gene editing to armor plants against disease, which they say could be the key to the future of farming. But not everyone is on board. We'll look at the newest technology and other intriguing stories from the world of science with science writer Gemma Tarlak. Gemma is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, Rob. I hope you're hungry for science.
I am indeed. And before we get to the gene editing of that food, which we'll be hungry for, let's start by talking about this is a piece you wrote yourself, this really humble stuff called ochre, O-C-H-R-E. It's dirt, a kind of dirt, right, and rocks, but it could be
technically a kind of rock.
Okay. And it's a key to the human story in a lot of ways. Tell us a little bit about ochre.
Yeah, well, ochre is basically defined as any really iron-rich rock. So it comes in a lot of different colors, yellow, purple, but red ochre is probably the most famous. And it is found all over the world in both a lot of modern cultures and also tons and tons of early human settlements and sites. And it's really exciting because in a lot of ways, the story of human evolution can be figured out by looking at ochre use, where it occurs, how it was used, what was left of it, and even talk about being hungry for science. There's even one theory that people who ate ochre, which some traditional cultures still do today, people who ate ochre were actually feeding their brains and boosting their nutrient intake, which may have led to the evolution of the modern human brain.
Now, ochre, you write, is often used as a pigment. The most famous one is red, though there are other colors of ochre. Does that the color have a big significance as to why people were using it?
Yeah, and that's also another really interesting thing. You know, humans, like other old world monkeys and apes, we have trichromatic vision. We can look out on the savanna, on the plains, whatever, and in a carpet of green, we can see red. We could spot even just a tiny bit of red. If you think of how much a red cardinal stands out against the winter landscape, for example. And basically, this trichromatic vision, the ability to see red, really is linked, they think, to why red ochre was so prominently used in so many different areas of our evolutionary story, because it was a way to signal to someone else. If you saw, you know, someone from maybe another settlement or another tribe or another group approaching you from a long distance away, if they were wearing red, that would signal, oh, this is one of my people. This is someone I can deal with. This is not necessarily an enemy. So they think that's one reason why we see so much red ochre use in the archaeological record.
Can we tell what kind of stuff people were doing with this ochre, the variety of things they might have used it for?
Yeah, well, you know, for decades, a lot of archaeologists and paleoanthropologists thought that it was used because it was red, because it was so visible over a distance. It was used as symbolic, as a way of communication. And also red is, of course, the color of blood and other things, so it also has a lot of symbolic value. But increasingly, just in the past couple decades, experimental archaeologists who actually try to create the stone tools and fire the Stone Age arrows, etc., to figure out how they were made and used, this branch of archaeology is actually finding that ochre appears to have been used as an adhesive, as a sunscreen, as an insect repellent, all these as a way to tan hides. All these really cool functional uses are just coming to light in the past decade or so.
And there's a deeper lesson here, you write. Ochre, the use of ochre, may be a symbol, a signal of an important stage in the development of our brains and how we interact with the world around us.
Yeah, exactly. And if you think about going back to the idea that someone would wear red ochre to be recognized from a long distance away by someone else, that implies a lot of things cognitively. One, it implies that you are putting this on to signal something, to communicate with someone who can read that signal and understand that communication. And it also implies you are on some level interacting socially with another group. And that implies all kinds of other things like trade and maybe, you know, the original social media network of just people going from one territory to another to exchange information and goods. And it's a really exciting hint of when modern human cognition was developing.
And we've used this phrase a lot in talking on this show, Gemma. This may, our study of ochre may push back the timetable for human development. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there's new research coming out that suggests this kind of modern human behavior evolved hundreds of thousands of years earlier than once thought.
And what's the next step for research on ochre and human development?
Well, there are a lot of really cool directions that ochre is taking. I mean, this is really kind of a hot time for this field because there are all new ways of studying it, including figuring out if the ochre found in a cave in South Africa, say, came from the immediate vicinity of that cave, or if it came from 20, 40, 100 miles away. They can figure that out now based on the unique geochemical signature of the material. And you might think, oh, so what? Well, the fact is, if you have a piece of ochre or another material that came from hundreds of miles away, that means that you or someone in your group had to travel that far or interact with people who live there. So that, again, implies all kinds of social and trade networks, which in itself applies more advanced cognition. So this is one of the, and they're finding new ways of figuring out these geochemical signatures to determine where the material came from versus where it was actually collected. This is opening a whole new world into understanding how people used ochre.
And before we move on from ochre, you mentioned a possible nutritional angle. This is some iron-rich mineral. People may have been intentionally or otherwise eating some of it.
Yeah, you know, interestingly, there are some traditional cultures, particularly in Africa, where people, especially pregnant women, do still eat ochre, and they think it's because they're boosting their iron uptake. But there's one researcher who suspects that eating ochre, especially when ingested with seafood, which is rich in a lot of very great brain-boosting nutrients, that combination actually may have put our species on the path towards developing the modern brains that we have. Now, I want to stress that this is very early research, and he's kind of an outlier. It has not been embraced by the field in general, but it's an intriguing look at how we may have gotten these big old brains that we're all walking around with.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the most intriguing stories in the world of science. Gemma, we've talked about CRISPR before. It's a gene editing tool, basically. Now scientists are trying to use it to protect produce crops from various kinds of disease. Let's first of all talk about the threat. A piece in Discover talks about orange crops, for example. There's some real threats to a lot of the food we count on.
Yes, you know, it's really shocking what's going on now in the citrus industry, and it's all because of this little bug that is carrying this bacteria that's causing citrus greening. This is a devastating disease, and just to give you an idea, in 1997, about 20 years ago, the annual haul of citrus crops from the U.S. was 244 million boxes. This year's predicted haul, 46 million boxes, which is the worst harvest since World War II. And it is largely due, some of it is Hurricane Irma, but it's largely due to citrus greening, which absolutely just, it devastates a tree. And now they're seeing citrus greening in just about every orange tree in those growing regions. It kills the tree within a couple years, and in the couple years of decline of the tree, it doesn't fruit, or the fruits are just misshapen and sour and basically not usable. So researchers are employing, again, this gene editing tool, CRISPR, to, instead of introducing, say, genes from another species, as is done with a lot of genetic modification these days, the idea with CRISPR is that it's so precise, you can go in and just knock out the gene that, say, is causing susceptibility to this disease, or you could even introduce a gene from another individual of the same species that has shown to be immune and shown to be successful against this disease. You could just kind of pop that gene right into the other individual. So it's a very precise and limited way of genetically addressing these susceptibilities to disease.
And federal regulations on this, I gather, are different since you're not taking something from another species and plugging it in. You're just doing it within stuff that's already in, say, the population of oranges. It's regulated differently than other what we call genetically modified organisms.
Yeah, because most of the genetically modified organisms out there are transgenic in that they will take, say, a snippet, and this is a gross oversimplification, but a snippet of fish DNA and stick it into a tomato, for example, because they want a certain trait in that tomato. That is not what CRISPR is. And because CRISPR is working within the individual organism or the individual species, it's not introducing any kind of exotic foreign material genetically, it is not considered transgenic, and it's actually not regulated. Right now, the government is taking kind of a hands-off approach because it does not involve this sort of exotic gene swapping that you see with other transgenic species.
And today, oranges, other crops that they're looking at doing this with?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's not just plants. A lot of it is crops, but I know they've used CRISPR successfully in pigs to make them immune to a pretty devastating disease. And they're also, you know, in addition to having these crops and livestock be less susceptible to disease, they're looking at ways to boost yield because, you know, we're going to have 10 billion people on the planet soon, and they all have to eat. And so they're looking for ways where they could create a new sustainable food system.
And finally, Gemma, you spent some time looking at 20 things we didn't know about diamonds. What struck you as most interesting about diamonds when you started digging in?
Oh, my gosh. You know, there is so much that's fascinating. I think one of my favorite things is, you know, the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain, but on Neptune, it falls in the center of the planet. Neptune is one of several planets in our solar system that has diamond rain, which I think is really cool, and it forms a couple different ways, either within the planet's core or even atmospherically. And, you know, I was fascinated by the Hope Diamond. I think that's kind of the most famous diamond around. It's a blue diamond, which means it's got a couple boron atoms in there to give it its gorgeous color. And when it was first mined in India in the mid-17th century, it was almost three times its current size. So if you think about how big the Hope Diamond is today when you see it in those gorgeous museum displays, it was originally three times bigger, which is pretty impressive in my book.
And you mentioned the color of diamonds. It takes really just a very few atoms within a diamond to change it from, you know, a diamond that's completely colorless to something else.
Yeah, just a couple boron atoms, for example, in the Hope Diamond. And if you put a few nitrogen atoms in a diamond, it will actually make it appear yellow or brown, depending on how many atoms. But it takes a tiny, tiny, minuscule amount, which is also pretty fascinating.
And when did diamonds first end up on playing cards?
We don't know, but it was probably in the late 1400s. And I didn't know this either until I started doing my research, that playing cards were likely invented more than 1,000 years ago in China. And they followed the trade routes all the way first to Egypt and then into Europe. Originally, though, like for the Egyptians example, their suits on the cards were swords, wands, cups, and coins. And the Europeans started using those suits, but over time developed their own, of course, we know, clubs, spades, hearts, and diamonds. So that's a medieval creation that has a very long, much older history, which I think is really cool.
And finally, why are diamonds, briefly, Gemma, so hard?
Well, it is because of their crazy electron pairs. They form this, so the five atoms form this tetrahedron, this very specific structure that actually they share electron pairs with each other. So that's why they are not just hard, but they are the hardest thing we know of, twice as hard as the closest competition, which is silicon nitride and cubic boron nitride.
Gemma, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. She joins us about once a month to share some cool stories from the world of science.